A gentleman that has decades of service to our country in the armed forces, government, and in industry, General Bob Edmonds, will share his insights on a range of defense topics, including an overview of the state of global security and threats, an outlook for the defense budget and spending, perspective on the early days of the new administration, that's going to be interesting, perspective on key programs, future trends in defense technology. General Edmonds was an F-15C Eagle pilot in the United States Air Force at numerous flying positions, both as an instructor pilot and an operations officer. He led 42 combat missions during Operation Desert Storm. He commanded the 95th Fighter Squadron at Tyndall Air Force Base, Florida, which was named the 325th Fighter Wing Squadron of the Year under his command. And he also commanded the 131st Fighter Wing, St. Louis, Missouri. He retired from the Air Force after 28 years of service with the rank of Brigadier General. His decorations include 2 Defense Superior Service Medals, 2 Legions of Merit, and 5 Air Medals. So after retiring from active duty, Bob spent nearly a decade of work in D.C. on Capitol Hill, in the White House, and in the Pentagon. He led the U.S. Air Force's Senate Liaison Office in the Russell Building on Capitol Hill during a momentous period of congressional history after September 11, 2001. And he also handled U.S. Air Force congressional affairs with both the House and the Senate as Deputy Director for Legislative Liaison. He was selected for the White House Fellowship in 1995, and he was a special assistant to the Administrator of the U.S. Small Business Administration as a member of President Clinton's cabinet. Bob currently reports to the President and CEO of Elbit Systems of America. It's a diversified global aerospace and defense provider of high-performance innovative solutions for defense, homeland security, commercial aviation, and medical instrumentation markets. He's responsible for the growth of the company, leading all marketing activities, which includes integrating and aligning business development strategy, corporate development, and strategic communication. His team works closely with the lines of business supporting the growth of the company. Bob was born and raised in Charlotte, North Carolina. He graduated from the Air Force Academy with a bachelor's of science in civil engineering. He earned a master's of civil engineering as a Guggenheim Fellow from Columbia University. And he also holds a master's in national security strategy from the National War College. He completed an executive education program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And Bob is a Falcon Foundation trustee and past president and board member of the White House Fellows Foundation and Association. Please help me in welcoming General Bob Edmonds, Vice President of Marketing for Elbit Systems.
I think that was probably longer than necessary. It's always good to hear what you've done periodically and remember back, though, because by the grace of God and some good teammates, you know, you have some successes in life and brought me here. But why am I here? Actually, I started this, it has a genesis in L.A. You know, of course, there's a genesis of the aerospace business there, and you're right, there's not much left. A little bit back in Space Park, Space and Missile Center from the Air Force is still there. And of course, that's the founding chapter. I know several of the members there. So I got an invite to speak there earlier in the year, which then led to the, well, I guess you did it okay, because I believe in the First Amendment. We have, anybody has a right to speak, but you have to earn the right to be heard. And so I think I earned the right to be heard. I gave a similar set of remarks, and then apparently it went okay, so asked to come back here. I think I have a little bit for everybody. I'll talk a little bit about what Elbit does, although the primary part of this presentation is one person's view of those items of where is the global threat, global national security environment, what's the responses to it, what are we doing in the future. I have one cool video for some of the, you know, the research. I thought we were here at Utari, I guess is how you say it. And so I have one pulled off cool video of advanced technology and some of the things that we're doing embedded in here. So keep it live here, not just speaking in slides. We got one video in there, which is good. and you know, close out with a little bit of just perspective on where do we think we're going, and everyone who has decades of experience or in commercial or military know that it's certainly a changing time. Elbit Systems is in our 25th year, or just around the corner here at Marine Creek. Was 93, Elbit Systems, parent company in Israel, bought the GD avionics plant, which is, for golfers, I say, is about a pitching wedge or a driver, if you, like me, got hit further across the way from Lockheed Martin era, so it made a lot of sense. But in that whole time in the 90s, when there was a lot of merger and consolidations going on, then Gord Dingell was running GD at the time as they were doing that, and it spun off. He's doing all the F-16 avionics, and that became the core, and it made a lot of sense leveraging with Elbit Systems in Israel, which had a long legacy of avionics and displays for military and commercial aircraft, primarily military. That kind of work goes into the, well, I would say fast forward into that line of one of our best known products is the helmet on the F-35. We have a joint venture with Rockwell Collins. They have the basic helmet, but we have the secret sauce and the guts that pulls that, you know, fantastic helmet out, which basically uses augmented reality. Everybody says, wow, you can see through the airplane. Well, I'd love to have had that as an F-15 guy. I didn't get to fly that kind of helmet, but as you look down below or behind, used to be the one each Mark I eyeball that we had to do to check the threat. Now you stitch together all the sensors and cameras and put in an augmented reality photo so you can see what's there, which is really great technology. And so helmet mounted displays are on Elbit does are on every fixed wing aircraft, F-15s, F-16s, F-18s. In the rotary world, the same, a variety of different helmet mounted kinds of, so you can cue both weapons as well as moving out using it. Because remember, the F-35 is the first airplane that does not have a head up display. Mm-hmm. It's here.
It's there.
So if you think about technology, you know, I think this is very, very disruptive. If you think about disruptive technology, you know, we start with a big computer, that was pretty good. Then you go to a PC, the disruption is still here. You go to a smartphone, now disruption is on the smartphone. And now as things have improved, now I say, now the disruption is the body is the platform. The brain is the platform. It's interfacing here with this in a way that has now put it on the front part. So have a strong presence in cockpits as one. We also have a strong presence in precision guided munitions. So we work with a lot of companies. We provide the semi-active lasers on the front end of a variety of different weapons. We've got a ground business that does things in all the different tanks, everything from controllers to environmental systems to displays. Again, the element is a lot like the old commercial, BASF. We don't make things, we just make them better because it's a subsystem supplier. Many people have commented, you know, where you are in the supply chain, we're down there in terms of being able to do that and provide it. We do make, build some platforms, some unmanned aerial systems, or in the Air Force it's called a remotely piloted aircraft, but there's nothing unmanned or womaned about flying a UAV, because it takes a lot of people, so it's just remotely piloted. And we build a number of them and sell them all around the world for it. Elbit, as a broader company, is about a $4 billion company, and Elbit Systems of America is at the $1 billion level, and a wholly owned U.S. subsidiary of that. And, we operate here in the U.S. in primarily defense world. It's interesting background for people in the business to also recognize we have a medical instrumentation business. It's maybe, wow, that's kind of interesting. About 10% of the revenue of our billion is with medical instrumentation. You go, well, where does that come from? Well, in the business world, your classic MBA is where do you grow your adjacency market when you're trying to work this in. And what happened years ago, there's a Dr. Colesman, who is the founder and inventor of the altimeter, the barometer for steam-driven gauges on an airplane. So the old Colesman company, that's where it started. But somewhere along the path, he said, hey, you know, we need to do an adjacency. We need to figure out where we can go on the side. So they said, instrumentation, precision, type of measuring, that's all very similar. So he went into the medical world. So you don't know of Elbit or Colesman. They're in New Hampshire. We bought them and enrolled them into the company about 8 years ago, 10 years ago. But you would know them because when you go get your blood drawn by your doctor and they send it out and they come back and say, here are your lab results. That's all the instrumentation and guts that we provide and build, both engineer and manufacturer, to put into some of the very, very large systems that the medical world uses. So we've got a piece of it that's there. In the commercial aviation world, we have a primary product that we sell called an enhanced vision system, which is, again, a very similar augmented reality type of situation where you take off a variety of different sensors, mostly cooled IR, single color, dual color, and be able to put a sensor out front and then be able to stitch in a VFR picture. So if you have a digital capability, every Gulfstream aircraft, FedEx, several military aircraft will have this in there. And now you can, if the weather is bad, you can land it as if it was VFR, because you'll put it up, you'll put a visual picture of a VFR approach. FAA just changed the rule and said, if you have a EVS, and we're the only one to have a flight FAA certified one, in your aircraft, then you can land at 0-0, you know, if your operations allows it. You know. So it's a...
Can't retreat.
Absolutely. So it's a very good operational benefit for that. So that's commercial aviation. We have a composites business in Israel, so we do sell some composites and other things on aircraft, as well as the standard metal and other types of things for that. The other piece of Elbit is a brief overview on Homeland Security. So, speaking of the new administration, everything's about the wall. So, Trump's wall. But we're right in the middle of that because years ago we won what I call the son of the big, big southern border contract. There was one called SBINet at a while, somebody nodding their head. It was a huge effort that DHS put out to put an integrated electronic net on the border. Boeing had the contract. I think it was just one they bid off too big too early.
It did.
Boeing didn't do so well. It doesn't really happen. Boeing doesn't do well, but they ended up terminating that contract. So they bid it off on a smaller piece. And we picked up that son of that called the integrated fixed towers. And what that was is a similar thing. You put some fixed towers along the border, and we started in Arizona, and you put all kinds of electronics fence across the board and then pipe that back into a command and control center so the CBP agents then have a look out early and then can pinpoint and go. And we've been doing that. We're just about across the Arizona border. We'll be going out through New Mexico and Texas and expanding it. So as a trusted agent within the border security world, the wall, which is really a fiscal wall, there is part of the dynamics happening in Washington where Trump needs to and wants to stand up in front of and say, I built something. But the reality is that it's not just that, you know, and he kind of knows it, but you got a campaign. And so it's part of the dynamics is he said, I've done a lot of work in Washington in that triangle of Capitol Hill, Pentagon, and the White House. And if anybody ever tells you they understand that, then they're lying. Because we've worked in a long time, we may know a little bit of the nuances and have some lessons learned that can help kind of wave your way through it. But it's a non-linear world for a bunch of us engineers. It said you have to figure out where and how to connect that those dots. I was actually the director of legislative affairs for the Air Force when we had the first tanker issue, the big problem we had to try to get that through. And so understanding that piece, and so in the wall world back in Washington now, there's a bunch of people in Congress that say, you know, I don't believe in just that. They held the last budget hostage because he wanted fiscal wall funding. He had to back off of it and say, no, we put in technology. Mm-hmm. Well, not bad. You know, that's kind of what we do. So we're about technology on the border for that piece. And then the heavy part of the business that people know from around here is the defense. That's a little bit of a layout on Elbit systems. We'll go through a few other things on the agenda as was indicated, and we'll go through here. My view of the global threat, it's clearly a different world. As you said, I showed up in Washington from an operational command. Then a month later, 911 hits, and I'm up on the hill, Capitol Hill, and we're working the Washington world. And that started us in a in an area where we've got now multi-domain threats, multi-spectral threats from down at the terrorism level, which in a lot of times people will sort of equate to a little bit at that bottom, somewhat low-tech in the military part, high-tech in the connecting people using social media and generating the momentum. But it's sort of like a little bit like a headache. You have to take an aspirin every once in a while. You'll have it happen. We've been very, very, very fortunate. If you look out in Paris or London or things routinely every week or so, you'll get an event that occurs. So you have to be vigilant. Here on our shores, we are vigilant. But we have to deal with that. And then you have to deal all the way up with now the resurgence of big state actors. So we went for a long time very, very focused in Afghanistan, rightfully so, after 9/11, and then into Iraq, into the Middle East. We've got from the Al-Qaeda to Taliban, now ISIS, very, very, even probably a larger threat than the first two, in my opinion, that are out. But it creates this mosaic that says we're defending on a lot of fronts. We're defending on fronts that are associated with borders in the sense that a large percentage in all countries of terrorist activity comes from illegal immigration, legal border crossing, embedding themselves in. So you have to look at it on a border security. You know, we didn't know what Ebola was going to do when it first came. If you think back, it's kind of fine now, but it was a major, major threat that we were concerned about across the board, which is a security issue. And then, of course, the idea just represents the hacking in the world that is also a threat to our way of life and national security. So if you see across the full spectrum of events, it's a pretty full and dynamic threat world. I marry this up with this increasing complex set of security issues with technology that's advancing faster now than the military technology. In the past, those of us as graybeards have been around a long time, the military always led the way with the best funding and the best opportunity, and still is trying to do that, but the catch-up rate in this commercial world, because many, many things can be quickly moved into a commercial environment and commercialization and selling it. So it's a much quicker from idea to funding to consumer as it gets a lot faster in a lot of these areas. And they have military application, so you can use them across the board in this. The cyber threat, this says if you can't read it, you know, top secret military systems downloading, you know, I think of it as the Chinese takeout. Well, you know, it's a little bit of a joke on the fact that, yeah, we got state actors working things, you got off-record actors working things, and you can't really know who's who, though. Now, super IT experts probably can figure that out, and we certainly have the capability, a lot of it through our government and tapped into the high-tech parts of the world that can help identify that. Now, the piece of this you've heard a lot of people talk about, you know, a threat to national security is the national debt. And the threat is because the debt is so high that you can't do the things you necessarily need to do because you can't fund it. So it becomes a threat to it because the debt's there. Think back, if you're in a situation and you say, okay, if I'm going to think through the 70s where we had a bathtub in capitalization and modernization, Reagan comes in and we have a big Reagan buildup. You think, well, we're going to do another buildup with Trump. We need to get back up. We're taking a bathtub in defense investment. Well, it was a little easier for Reagan at the time because he didn't have a national debt and an interest on the debt that he had to pay like we do now. So there's still a squeeze, and we'll talk a little bit about that more in the budget part of the charts in my, as I look at it. So a lot of different factors at play. The national security domain in D.C. for national security professionals and policy professionals are talking about now the national security threat in this lexicon, the 4+1 framework, meaning the four, Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran, in terms of the state threats, the state focus, and tie that into the plus one across global violent extremism that's that cuts across the board. And ISIS represents that, as ISIS's belief. If you look at their web pages and their intent is to grow the caliphate back all the way across. They would love to grow that caliphate out where it used to be a very large, even into other countries. We're fortunate to be around the separated by this the ocean, but that is a major underarching piece as it comes through and into the Northern Africa part. Now, our relations with the two major countries are really about maintaining the type of relations and the openness and the thing that we can do to advance the world in a peaceful way. But we have to be prepared because they're major actors and they have their own sovereignty and their own issues, their own agendas in terms of where they want to go. And if they collide, you have to be ready to do that. So this is the framework that's being looked at across multi-domain. So you might hear people talk about multi-domain warfare, multi-domain national security policy, and that's put on. It's got to be integrated across all of these. It's no longer, let's just pay attention to the land and let the Army and Marine Corps handle that. All okay, it cannot be. It's got to be connected. So you have to be thinking about it in a broad sense of the way. Throughout this, a little bit of a flow on what I believe as the American way of war is changing. And the way of war is changing, if you look at it from a historical perspective, helps you understand what you need to do today in order to have an effective military and effective national security deterrent. Because if you look at in the past, it was always about taking the geographic isolation. I just mentioned the oceans were around. Go project in a secure overseas base, build allied coalitions, establish supremacy, and then rely on technical overmatch. Well, a lot of these things are being differently changed by adversary improvements. We have a budget problem, so we can't be as many overseas bases as we would like to be. So we pulled back part of the base realignment, part of base closure was all about coming back out. Of course, the new administration, you hear Trump go over and say out loud what a lot of people have been saying for many years. Look, we believe in NATO, but you got to pay your fair share. It says it right here in the document, but you're not. You're always relying on the U.S., you know, our military, the next military budget down is a tenth of it. See, they add up the next four together, they add up our military budget, what we've done. We do continue to build and leverage allied coalitions, so it's more and more and more important to do that now. This is becoming harder and harder to do because we don't have as much overmatch in the key areas. In some of the areas that are indicated here are areas where the both adversaries and somewhat because of the commercial capability have been able to advance just about as fast as that. So how we counter that is important, and how suppliers, particularly in those areas of higher technology, entrepreneurial research institutes like we're sitting in here today, can help advance that and stay in front. The third offset strategy that people have heard about in the last 4 to 5 to 6 years was a strategy that said the next offset, the next move to as a nation to be advanced in front of with a technical overmatch needs to be in many of these areas. We don't have all that capability in the military, so we need to stretch it out and look at it. And, of course, the first look was sort of over towards Silicon Valley, which is a great place to start. So given that as a basis of where the global market is, the global security environment is, and the future look at the market, I'll go into a little bit of future trends in the defense business. I'm doing it with a lay down of a historical look back before I do actually into the future to set a little bit of a stage here. So, nothing that anybody here doesn't know about. This is the bathtub that we took for a while with the defense budgets going down. Recognition of it sort of leveling off and kind of start up here. I'll talk a little bit more about 17 and 18 in a minute. But the key point is that because of this, the buying power and buying habits of the customer changed. The customer meaning the Department of Defense for all of us primarily have worked there by a defense presentation. And because the buying power, less money, buying habits, how you do it, because you don't have as much money, change. in the military priorities have had to change. The strategy has shifted across the Asia Pacific was something that the nation looked at and said, well, we've got major state actors in Russia and China. We think we're coming out of Afghanistan and Iraq, and of course the reality of it was you really couldn't. It's that low level type that's sort of continued, and then ICE actually has risen up since that strategy. And then the Russia resurgence. So now we've been pulled back to Europe and pulled back into the Middle East, so it's not fully realized across there. And then we're leveraging technology, as we said. So those priorities have changed. Are we going to get some sequestration relief? Well, as we move into the future, I think that is true. The Trump administration has signaled that they are going to push for the repeal of the law. They used the word sequestration. It was actually a law that was brought in. And so they were going to try to repeal it. The budgets recently have been greater than the sequester number, but less than what's needed for a key program. This line is to represent and show that way back when, and it was in the area when at the bottom of the trough here, you said, okay, now if we were to now look post, we are in the bottom. What do we need for the future? There was a 5-year defense plan that was put in with one of the budgets, 12, that said, this is what we really need. So in the president's budget in 2016, when it was put out, this was the 5-year growth plan. We've never even got there, is the point of that. That was the requirement at the minimum that was looked back in 16, the fiscal year 16. That was a requirement level. Of course, this is where we've been because of the sequestration, the Budget Control Act. We've gotten a little bit of an agreement to grow it a little bit. That was a drug deal done by Congress and the administration. And then we've got some overseas contingency operations, or OCO as they call it, which is extra relief on top. So you can get a little bit, but you're not there. That's the point of, even then, we're not there on what level is needed for key programs. So as we move into the future now, where you see some of this stuff going, and what's my opinion about how to attack that, is that the business climate is going to be shaped a lot by what the U.S. government buys from the suppliers. The suppliers have to be part of the disruption, have to be part of understanding that that we need to have all of these factors taken into account. We talked about this one, the change in doctrine, rapid technology growth. We've had some sustained slow economic growth. The hope is in the future, it's not panned out yet, that at 3% a year, or if we use that kind of economic growth in order to fund additional money into the coffers of the checkbook, be able to afford more. That's yet to be seen. In the meantime, we factor on, which is a major one, the lack of political consensus, even though the Republicans control both houses of Congress and the president, you see that there's an element that still doesn't like the fact that Trump was elected. So we're going to do whatever it takes to, and that's both on the R and the D side, because there's some very right side Republicans who are Tea Party or balanced budget or fiscal hawks who may be strong in defense and strong in others, aligned in the Republican Party, but they don't want to increase budgets. And then you got a farther left side that says, you know, my candidate didn't win, I'm going to do whatever it takes to disrupt you because I don't want to have action, which is a sad thing for Americans to not come together, personal opinion. But that's caused this lack of consensus, you know, across the board. You see a lot of issues with regard to how do we get, you know, the types of things done, not just a defense buildup, but how do you work health care and how do you do some of the tax reform and other major, major pieces that are being debated right now. So there are some opportunities. You got to figure out where they are. So companies like Elbit, companies like yours, companies like those that you work for, we're trying to look through our crystal balls, trying to figure out where can you exploit and get into the crack and find an area that is necessary. So you start with what are the new priorities. We've talked about the top one, A2AD, for those that may not be as familiar, anti-access, anti-denial, meaning a defense environment where electronic net and other kinds of defenses has created a hard way to get into and attack the enemy. That term has sort of fallen off a little bit towards, it's just got to be a multi-domain challenge. The look back. Okay. If we look at these areas, which were on the previous chart, and align them against sourcing. So this is what I think from a company standpoint to say, if you need to do the things that are necessary to meet the defense priorities on the left, which are those necessary in this complex environment, then the response will be across the board. So what are the things we need to do? Well, my belief is that if you're on a major program, there's tech refreshes and upgrades. So pay attention to what's necessary on the current programs, because even though we want to build new ones, you're going to have to refresh the current ones because we can't afford to totally recapitalize. The types of R&D and advanced concept, a lot of that work has now been shifted and you have to invest in it. You know, you've got grants and working here funded by companies are funding their own more often now. A little less of the government work, trying to make that balance between government-funded R&D, shifting some priorities to industry R&D because we want to take some money from the government-funded R&D and put it into capitalization and buying platforms. So it's a balance there across it. So there's more reliance on early contractor-funded work. So you got to pay attention to that and how much we will put in our internal R&D. Open system architecture is a major issue. The government no longer wants to be held hostage by companies that own the IP. We've seen that a lot occurring now. You've got a big platform. You go back and want to make one software line change, and because you got to open up the whole architecture, so the bill comes back for multi-$1 million. Not good for that as well. So they're getting smarter and requiring open system architectures in their requirements to move along. I call it the convergence of RF and cyber functionalities. So one of the things that is that a recognition of cyber's got a variety of different definitions. And I look at it in a domain, though. Sometimes people talk about cyber and have been so much more so in the past 3 to 4 to 5 years, says cyber, you're just thinking about, I just need to make sure that this is secure or your PC is secure, and it's in an IA way. But in reality, it's much broader than that now. You know, people are talking about the cyber domain. It's across the movement of data, the movement of electrons. And so we're talking about it in our company and others. I hear it's called assured processing. So let's talk about the assured processing of whatever the capability of that 0 and 1 is. And if you assure it, you got to protect it. So the assured processing of a box, those of us in the aviation business, a line replaceable unit, LRU, some kind of avionics box, let's make sure that works. If you look at F-35, those of us in fighter pilots will say, we used to say speed is life. Think about Top Gun. Speed is life. Well, I'm talking about buds that are flying F-35 now. They're saying information is life. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's stealth. It can go fast. Not as fast as F-22 or F-15, but it's really now info is life. So information is life because it is a node in the sky. It's a network. It's going to help be a command and control across the board. It can't do its job if it's not secure across both the data that it's sending back and forth, the data it's getting, and on board the processing that's occurred. So I think that's a major, major change in what's happened across the board. So these are the kind of things that are a response to that, and it leads to what I call the fast stream sectors. So the company out of D.C., Renaissance Advisors, we pulled them together to get started thinking about if you were to make a bet as a defense company and do your own internal research, where you think the necessary needs, where you're going to focus. You got to do it in the areas that they're going to spend money in that match up all the stuff that we've talked about now. And so here's 12 different areas that are fast stream sectors. Some things that aren't surprising to anybody, and we touched on a lot of the different ones here based on the threat and the need and the part. I was walking through the hall here, of course, and Utari, just like many, many places, has an autonomous systems area. I mean, we're focusing on that at Elbit, and we have a major growth area called Precision Technology and Autonomous Ops. Now, we put it together for a reason. Precision Technology and Autonomous Operations, because you can't do one, you can do precision technology, but if you're going to do autonomous ops, you've got to be precise, both in precise in geolocation and GPS and direction. Then you have to be able to use the type of autonomous operations to be able to move things. And they can be applied across a spectrum of land to sea, to ground, to even into space across this world. And, of course, that we see both commercial as well, you know, from Google self-driving cars and otherwise, this autonomous operations, Amazon delivering. Our company, in the part of my growth hat I'm wearing, I've got the advanced technology sector, and I'm working a new business line up in North Dakota. So I was just in Fargo last week. It's good to be in Fargo in the summer, though. What a beautiful day. It was 70 degrees and sunny in the summer. But we're doing precision agriculture with our UAVs, like you see. The same sensors that we use for military application, I'm using the same RGB, multispectral types of sensors to do agriculture. Mm-hmm. I'm also using the same sensors and cameras and high-definition imagery to do emergency response. We did a big exercise last week. That's why I was up there with Xcel Energy to do emergency response, to be able to look at down power lines that are impacted, issues with medical necessary for emergency. Can we pinpoint them to a site? So this kind of technology can be used for that as well. So all these things are the types of drivers for the fast streams. Now, here we are with the video. So this is a video about some new cool high technology areas that are happening and research is going into, that some are already fielded and some will be fielded. So one look at this. Whoops, backward. Now I'm not sure there. Let me see. What do I hit on this to get that to start? Can you just start it? There you go. Okay, it's queuing up. Here we go. Thank you. across the those types of technologies, there's a variety of ones that, in terms of the types of autonomous systems we looked at, game controllers, drones. Just a side point, most military don't call it drones. You know, military, because we shoot at drones, and we always use them for target practice, and there have been some that have hung behind airplanes. More of an argument, but the autonomous world. The one that was landed on the aircraft carrier is pretty cool. That's a Northrop Grumman system that was a fighter size refueling landing on a carrier, which is one of the hardest things to do as an aviator. But it's precise technology, autonomous operations. Example of why I kind of move them together there. All right, we'll close out here with a few charts on the outlook for the future defense systems. A couple programs that, in my view, of the budget, a little bit of the look from Washington. Like many companies, we have a government relations office there. It's been in the D.C. area for a long time. And the point of this is that if you look at the historical look of where the budget went, it was increased by overseas contingency operation funds, but the base budget has stayed relatively flat across. And that's projected to be flat. I'll show you a chart that we think from the standpoint of the growth that is occurring and with the Trump administration that we are projecting. But today, you know, we're still at a point where the total budget has been relatively flat in the last few years. But the positive, the outlook's positive. Now, everything's on scale. So the point about this is that when 17, the fiscal year 17, which is what we're in now, really didn't get enacted until a month ago because of the issues associated with there's going to be an election, we're going to do a continuing resolution, look at Trump administration will get in. That was the big fight they had about what's that going to be? Can we get the budget in? Okay, we're not going to have any. We had to acquiesce and not have any fiscal wall funding in the budget. That was a major key effort of the whole budget, not just DOD, in order to get the budget through. Then he put in a new 18 budget. And then as we put in the 18 budget, what is of note is that normally when a president's budget goes in, it's accompanied with the year for execution plus five-year spending plan in the Defense Department, because you look at long-term programs. That was not included because you're trying to figure out what 18 was going to be. The 19 budget, which won't be released until next February, is the one that everyone expects to have the biggest spike with the Trump, because it'll be the one that's just primarily with the Trump administration. But in the meantime, there is a small somewhat of an upward growth pattern in the base budget here, and then these are the types of things within it. But then the base budget is there above whatever is going to be above it. But the fiscal year 18 budget that just came out was really only $18 billion above Obama's plans for the same year, so it wasn't a major spike. But he said we expect the biggest spike to occur in the fiscal year 19 budget. So you're not going to see a major. $18 billion is a lot of money, but certainly not. We expect it to be even higher. What about the Trump administration? Some implications on what we see in terms of their priorities so far. I think that there's still a very much focus on countering ISIS, but to increase readiness. So there's a large conversation going on about the increased readiness, both the increased number of people in the Army and the Marine Corps, capitalization of ships, more airplanes. So that the reality is trying to squeeze it in order to be able to do that. But it's all on the mosaic of an administration position on U.S. jobs. So it's important, you know, that it's U.S. companies. Elbit Systems actually, we're a wholly owned U.S. subsidiary. We're a fully U.S. company, and we want to tout that. But we also created a manufacturing plant right here near our one in Marine Creek that does all types of manufacturing for overseas work in Israel, but it's done here with U.S. jobs. And it was something we had before even Trump administration to say it's important about jobs is do the manufacturing here and then send it back into Israel. The America First posture, what's that going to mean to us? We've seen it in terms of some of the issues around immigration. We've seen it in terms of the types of the foreign influence of companies and winners of jobs. I think it's new and existing platform. Don't just think that we're going to build up and buy new airplanes and new ships. again, if you're on a platform, you're on a platform. A couple of key programs, and then we'll wrap it up. The early Trump bump is on existing programs. So this mosaic is to indicate that, you know, if you're a company and you're on any one of the existing platforms, from an F-18 to a tank to, you know, certainly a higher tech F-35 like we're on, Boeing's F-15, you're in a great place to catch the bump because of the increase in funding and existing programs. The key, of course, is to get on the newer programs too. The next big airplane program for the Air Force is a new trainer, and the two big companies are fighting against with that. The next helicopter is a future version of the lift. Get on that. Somebody was talking about the CH-53K. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. This is an F-35. Hard to believe.
Yeah.
So it's going to be hard to compete against a heavy lift CH-47, I think. But great airplane. The Marine Corps loves it, and we'll figure if we can get that out. F-35 is long-term annuity. It's going to be around for a long time. I think we will see a ramp increase in 19 particularly, because the sooner you can get the ramp increase up, you talk about increase 787, the more you do, the unit costs will get down, and they're going to get F-35 down to below $80 million a copy, and I think that's doable. So I think you're going to see a ramp a little bit faster. These are when the lots come out. I think you're going to see a ramp in here a little bit more rapidly as you come across, because we are going to see some international sales increase more. You saw Trump, he negotiated directly with Lockheed Marathon on that. He's involved. New tanker.
That's a problem.
Yeah, they're trying to get the new tanker out. They're focused right now on, they had this first OT&E flights, and not going to lock that. The Boeing has lost some money on it, but they think the long term, they hope it's the later ones, the follow-ons, which they'll make money on. But in the meantime, the older tanker's going to stay flying. New trainer. That's an area where the Air Force is calling for 350, but it's probably going to be closer to 1,000 when you look at the long-term nature of, once they pick a new trainer, other countries pick a new trainer, the Air Force is going to use it for more than just training. So it's a viable program, and it's going to be one that could clearly be a long-term annuity as well. Super Hornet's going to be around. Like the F-15, F-18, you're going to have to keep them because we can't retire them before. And so if you're on the Hornet, these are representative of countries that are now buying more F-18s in lieu of or waiting for F-35s. So those are just a little bit of a quick rundown of that.
So in February, the Navy had 60% of their F-18 Super Hornets grounded.
Mm-hmm.
They've got to fix the problem. Going to be around.
Yeah. There's a, I would say just to that, I think that's exactly right. With older airplanes like Hornets, I mean, they're later production ones, F-15s later production ones, but they're still, some of them are still flying, they're 20, 25 years old, and you've got structural problems with them. They'll go through the service life extension programs. The Navy's got a problem like the Air Force had a few years ago with the oxygen system issue that has to do with health monitoring because of the nature of these higher technology airplanes, to be able to monitor the pilot's health, both with oxygen and with G forces. But yeah, so and that goes to the readiness piece. You got to have money in the readiness budget, the current operations and maintenance budget, O&M budget they call it, in order to match that. And those budgets have taken tremendous hits with the budget crisis we've had in the last 3 to 4 years. The Air Force still has a pilot shortage. Not one, because you'll have a pilot shortage if airlines are hiring. But two, they had to cut back on training because they had to put all their money for spare parts and their pilots up front to fly in combat. And they couldn't do the training to get new pilots trained in fighter aircraft, so it's a complicated problem. Other questions? Comments around the table?
Would you like to comment on the change over the decades and like collateral damage and the tolerance and
oh, yeah.
You know, in the future, you know, World War II, right, more civilians, I think, were killed than military. And now, it's like, I'm not sure where we go. I mean, I was looking at your fast, where we're going in the future, and how do you pull the trigger if there's no collateral damage?
Well, that's a major operational constriction restriction and constraint that we're dealing with. I think that's just the future new way of war. I mean, it's been driven somewhat by, not that we think 2 days ago, D-Day anniversary, and everybody looks back on it, you started with World War II, and you're fighting through the cities of Europe. So there was always urban warfare. It's more so urban warfare now because a lot of it, particularly the terrorist fight, you can't tell the difference. So in the ISIS fight, one of the things that's right now is a major issue is precision munitions. Its inventories are very, very low. So from a business standpoint, we are taking steps on our own dime to increase our rate of production of semi-active lasers to go on the front of munitions because anticipation of everything we hear, they're going to need it. We're hearing all the budgets being thrown at it. It's necessary. They're just not going to operate a laser versus a GPS are both precision, but a laser weapon you can use against moving targets and it would be a little more discriminative. Of course, it's different. You've got to be targeted with a laser versus just a GPS, but you can do a moving target. You can also be precise at the end game if you need it. So my comment is that we need all the precision technology and the types of operations because it's not going to change. I mean, although we didn't just drop the mother of all bombs, if everybody saw that. Stands for something else, right? But, it's always a good acronym. But that was more about, because it was in a big desert environment, you knew they were underground, so they built some tunnels, and you could pop it down on there, and it still didn't create a collateral damage, because there was nothing else there but the desert. But when we found the pinpoint location of where those that underground tunnels and the bunker was.
Any more questions for Bob?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I tend to look at defense technology from the BAA standpoint, broad agency announcements.
Yeah.
Solutions needed, and you know what they are, then you know what I'm talking about. They really haven't changed. Yeah. The BAAs just never change for 4 years.
Right.
Well, I just wanted to hear what your take on. DOD is really looking for. I mean, it's like.
Well, I have sort of two answers to that, two perspectives. One is that, an operation that's as big as the Department of Defense is, in the analogy of a big ship, it takes a long time to turn it. And one of the things that I looked at, what happened in the military defense market, now I'm in the private sector, there's a fault on both sides. There's a lot of senior leader talking, and you see that in companies. I call it a double fault because it happens in companies too. Senior leaders are going in a certain direction, but whether it translates down through the layers into the program managers, into the acquisition officials, into the people writing the broader announcements, sometimes it takes a long time to do that. So it takes a while. I mean, we're seeing a few things. But then the second, what I think is really the dynamics that's happening, is that we did an analysis, particularly because a company with foci mitigation as an internationally owned company, foreign owned company, we did an analysis of the budgets that are accessible to us in a secret or below area, and it's squeezing. So if I do that, the black programs and the highly classified TS and higher programs are increasing. And so if you're inside that tent, which in my previous company, I was with ITT Excellus. When I got out of the Air Force, first went into ITT and then Excellus. We got bought by Harris, and then I ejected out of that airplane into Elbit. And so we were, we had a TSSCI clearance. And so I was in that world, and I noted that too. So the BAAs and the requirements I was seeing that weren't published were tracking more along the line of the new stuff. And so if you think about it, that's the front end, particularly in the areas that are necessary. It's even more important. We did an analysis and said, now we need to go out. So now I'm out trying to buy a company to give us a TS capability. And put it under a proxy versus our current Rhode Island Education Board.
Now, you mentioned a couple things. Does Elbit, for instance, go after the life support aspects of the trainer, and the F-22, and the 35, and the 18, all these complaints coming in from pilots?
So,
first, you take like the training and simulation, and do you want to expand in that, and then you go over and work the life support side of high performance?
So, we do in the life support side, and we do it in the as the avenue is through our helmet. So we've created a health monitoring system within the helmet that allows us to do the connections into the brain, because you're wearing this, that's that can monitor all kinds of pieces and then display that through, just like I'm taking the helmet to display sensor data here, I'm displaying pilot data to it. That's how we're attacking it. And so we have a program where we've been demoing it with the Navy and the Air Force right now and determine if we want to do a change order in the helmets and put it in the helmet. It's another example, though, like it's an interesting point about technology, because you have to have a digital avionics. Digital. A lot of people say, well, remember, you got all these nice, cool displays for the F-15. A lot of those are still analog. Even though they may look like they're put out in display, the newest type, F-35, F-22, that's all digital. So you have to have a digital capability to display it so that you can take that data, turn it from the zeros and ones, and put it in a useful way. So we're attacking it from that standpoint.
Yeah, a lot of it's still steam gauges.
I'm sorry?
A lot of it's still steam gauges, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, they're still steam gauges. It's amazing how many. I mean, we're still doing the old cold room business while it's medical instrumentation on the side. You know, I'm talking about it. We're still selling a bunch of altimeters and barometers, the old gauges, just as replacement parts.
So we've got a pretty stubborn businessman running the country, and there's this young, left behind the ears kid in North Korea. Where do you see that going?
I think we're on glide path for a conflict. I think he's wet behind the ears, but I don't think that he is totally irrational, like everyone says. I think he clearly knows what he's doing, and he's doing it for his own personal sovereignty agenda. And he does it in a way that is pretty tapped at certain times to be able to do it. And even his father was doing that before, launching on our 4th of July. And
give money down.
Yeah, so... when I visited there, a couple of dynamics that I see in that area, that I was amazed at how many South Koreans want unification. So if you ever visit there, I mean, if you think about it, you go, okay, this sort of forced armistice, if you go back and learn the history, and a lot of families got divided, and there's a lot of them that really want unification, which is, we've got a heavy presence. If any place we have a heavy presence still in the world, you know, with our pullbacks from Europe and others, is in Korea and South Korea. They've got a lot of high technology. We really are married up with them. There's some question of, you know, whether you could, is there a peaceful resolution to it? I think many of the South Koreans would like that. I think North Korea still believes that, they don't want to be subsumed. They've got the pride and everything that's associated with it. And because there's two societies there, the upper class, they live very well like everybody else, and so, you know, there's no personal threat there with it, and they're fine. I think he's going to continue doing what he's going to do. The concern, of course, has always been, you know, where's China and Russia fit into this play, and so it's a complex political, geopolitical dimension. But I think we're on the path. I think we got to be real careful. Like Trump will, if you go back to Trump being a businessman and thing, I think that goes to other a piece of related to that question. I'll just answer one people ask me. They go, man, Washington's crazy. We've never seen this before. And he doesn't know what the hell's going on. Well, he knows what's going on. I mean, I think he's doing it in a different way, because we have not had a businessman as a president for 40 years. I mean, let's go back. I mean, some people have had, if you think about it, I mean, you can go back gotta go pretty Eisenhower a lot of times to say. So people that don't, he's coming in through a different prism of running a business and making very fast decisions. Sometimes you make a risk and it doesn't work, and sometimes you don't. So I think he's got to be tempered a little bit in it, but he's got a method to his madness as well, with where he wants to go. The problem, of course, in the national security global environment is that you don't want to hit a tripwire that he is not comfortable with, because he's not been in an environment where a tweet or a comment can kick a whole nation off. And we've seen that already. And so loads of the military environment, guys that I know that are still in, you know, sort of cringe a little bit in terms of, you know, they've got to be on watch more often to what does that mean towards it. I mean, we just saw a reaction to his comment in Saudi Arabia with the cut off of Qatar. And now, but you can't just say I'm going to be, America first is fine. And as he said in the Paris Accord, you know, I was elected by the people of Pittsburgh and not Paris, but, you know, that's a nice trite phrase, but globalization has already taken over. I mean, you can't do the fact that he on one hand says, I believe in U.S. jobs and I've got a $21 billion defense deal to Qatar that's now in jeopardy because he's cut them off from the rest of the world. And
so, but he's got Saudi Arabia now.
But he's got Saudi Arabia now. So it's a multidimensional dynamic.
Yeah.
We've had a kind of discussion here about the companies moving their facilities from California to Texas.
And yes, right.
I've recently heard about Lockheed Skunk Works coming to Fort Worth. Do you have any knowledge about that?
I've heard some of those rumors, but that's all I've heard.
I don't think that's going to happen.
They're already here.
They're already here.
25% is
located in Fort Worth. Right out here in Fort Worth. But the big building is done in Palmdale. Yeah.
That's hard to move Palmdale.
All that stuff in Palmdale is in jeopardy because all the back shops have left town. There's no back shops. I mean, so you got the final assembly operation, you got the engineers, the scientists, all that kind of thing, but the back shops gone. And that's basically for California regulations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just can't do anything like you're used to doing in Texas and in California.
Well, the new bomber will be built there in California.
Yeah.
That's true.
So, I mean, there's...
But right now, it's a paper bomber. So,
yeah, but it's going to happen.
Yeah,
it's been a long conversation.
With your years of service, I'm interested in your take on the loyalty pledge comments that we're going to hear more about today in terms of...
My perspective is that there's nothing new. I mean, I won't get down into the FBI versus the director who's supposed to be a 10-year guy and loyalty and where that lands, but you know, from a military perspective, I've been in. You know, there was always the when you get confirmed as a general officer, you acknowledge to your confirmation of the Senate that you will provide unfettered advice and it won't be held. But you do have a civilian leader, because that's the way we are as a nation. We have civilian leadership over the military. But I'll go back to loyalty and say my perspective on it is that it's not unusual, because in the Rumsfeld Pentagon. You pledge loyalty to Rumsfeld to the point where he had you actually sign NDAs, which is, you go, wait a minute, I'm in the building. I've never done that before, you know. You sign a lot of NDAs in the world of business, but this was a piece there. So I think that's a piece of control, certainly. And I think that more broadly speaking, most people, even though in the take back to the one microcosm of sort of Rumsfeld Pentagon, was that, okay, we'll do it because, you know, that's my job. I'm going to do it the best I can. If you want me to do it, I'll maintain the secrecy. It'll only come through you. We'll be loyal to you as you're trying to craft and move it. And a lot of people saw it as a two-faced thing. If you're going to move anything, you got to make sure you're focused and structured and you don't have a lot of external influences or people derailing it. Washington's a non-linear world, I said. So I think in one hand, it's a positive thing. Rumsfeld wanted an agenda and moving. He didn't want something derailing it because the various forces would hear about it and backstab it off the map. So there's some positive pieces of that. But then there's also the piece that you then you know you're operating under the best ethical, moral, and sound advice that comes from your professional judgment. That comes from an individual, and no one person. That's what we all learn. And I said at the beginning, you know, hey, by the grace of God and a lot of great teammates, you know, you're successful in life, and I think that he knows that a lot. It takes a lot of people to do that. So if you focus on one and constrict them and don't allow them to talk, then we're not going to be better off for it. My belief.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for your time and preparation. This has been just really delightful.
You're welcome.
We appreciate your coming over and talking to us this morning. Thank you.
You're welcome.